Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here again today. I've had the benefit of the committee's patience and courtesy on many occasions in the past, and I'm glad to have it one more time. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would like to ask that my prepared statement be put into the record, but so that we can shorten the time and get to the questions, I will abbreviate it.
Without objection, I will read that.
I believe that Secretary Muskie has touched enough on the background to set the scene, and if I may, I would like to turn directly to the declarations of Algiers and the accompanying documents. Through the long agony of the holding of the hostages, the United States held firm to two basic principles: that we would work unceasingly for the support of the hostages and for their prompt and safe return, and that our efforts must be consistent with our national interests and our national honor. The declarations of Algiers, which brought about the release of the hostages, are, in my judgment, faithful to these two basic principles. The following are, in my judgment, the net results of the declarations of Algiers. First, the United States has not apologized to Iran. Second, the United States has not paid ransom to Iran, but on the contrary, the only funds to be paid to Iran are those owned by Iran, and in fact, substantial amounts of Iranian funds are to be held to pay U.S. claims. Third, the United States has not taken sides in the Iraq-Iran conflict and has maintained its position of non-involvement. Fourth, the Shah was not returned to Iran, and Iran's claims to the property of the Shah and his family will be given effect only if adjudicated in United States courts in full accordance with due process of law. Fifth, an international arbitral tribunal backed up by a $1 billion security fund will be set up in order to hear and pay the commercial claims of U.S. citizens against Iran. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to address each of these five summary points briefly in the course of my testimony. First, with respect to the apology issue, neither of the two declarations of Algiers nor any of the associated documents contains any provision which could constitute an apology by the United States. The non-intervention pledge in point one of the basic declaration is merely a reiteration of existing U.S. policy when it states that it is now and from now on will be the policy of the United States not to intervene in the internal affairs of Iran. During the negotiations, Iran sought to have the non-intervention pledge stated solely in prospective terms, that is, from now on will be. That formulation was apparently intended to imply that the United States was changing its policy in return for the release. That formulation was rejected, and the terminology that exists in the declaration represents no more than a reiteration of our frequently stated current U.S. policy. Second, with respect to the ransom issue. Under the declarations, the release of the hostages occurred without the payment of any funds or property of the United States or United States nationals. The only funds or properties which are required to be paid over to Iran are Iranian funds or properties which were frozen by the November 14th order of President Carter. These provisions are in accordance with the basic principle of the declaration that the parties would work insofar as possible toward a restoration of the financial situation which existed prior to the freeze order. But in this connection, it must be remembered, as Secretary Muskie has said, that the economic sanctions imposed upon Iran exacted a heavy price in terms of the isolation of Iran and the severe disruption of its economy. Two categories of Iran's assets, that is, those in the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and those in foreign branches of U.S. banks, were paid into an escrow account in the Bank of England. And, of course, it was this rather dramatic payment which triggered the release of the hostages on the 20th of January. It's not widely understood, but very significant, I think, that only about 36% of the funds and securities that were paid into this escrow in the Bank of England were actually paid over to Iran. Specifically, of the $7.955 billion, which was the trigger amount required to be paid into the Bank of England escrow, $3.67 billion was used to pay off debts of Iran to U.S. banks. $1.4 billion was retained in an escrow account for the purpose of paying any disputed amounts, and only the remainder, about $2.88 billion, was paid to Iran. Although other categories of Iran's assets are ultimately required to be transferred to Iran, $1 billion of those assets will be placed in a security account to be used for the purpose of paying off claims of U.S. citizens in accordance with the claim settlement procedure, which I'll discuss in a moment. Thus, to summarize, since only Iranian funds were used for the release of the hostages, it is plain that no ransom was paid. Third, let me address briefly the non-involvement in the Iraq-Iran conflict. Since the outbreak of that war on September 22nd, fears have been expressed that in connection with the release of the hostages, the United States might agree to undertake a new military supply arrangement with Iran or to deliver a large amount of war material to Iran. To have done so would have brought charges and concerns that the United States had taken sides in the war and compromised its position of non-involvement. I'm glad to say that the declarations permit the United States to maintain its position of non-involvement in the war. The United States is neither committed to undertake a new military supply arrangement with Iran nor to turn over large amounts of war materials. Indeed, the declarations contain absolutely no reference to military supplies or war materials. In connection with the requirement that the United States transfer properties in the United States to Iran, the non-involvement of the United States is fully protected by the provision that the transfer is, and I quote now, subject to the provisions of U.S. law applicable prior to November 14, 1979. This means that the usual export and munitions controls will apply to transfers of property to Iran. This will enable the United States to ensure that any transfers do not result in our taking sides or otherwise becoming involved in the conflict. Fourth, let me speak briefly to the question of the Shah's assets. Throughout the crisis, Iran attempted to insist on a return of the wealth of the former Shah and his family. This demand was pressed even more vigorously after the death of the Shah in late August 1980. As recently as December 19th, just before Christmas, Iran was demanding the establishment by the United States of a $10 billion guarantee fund to ensure the return of the Shah's wealth. During the negotiations, the United States never deviated from the position that under our system of government, the transfer of private property from one party to another can be ordered only pursuant to procedures which afford due process of law. Late in the negotiations, Iran finally accepted that principle, and that principle is built into the declarations. As a result, the Shah's estate and his close relatives will have the full protection of due process of law with respect to claims against their properties made by the government of Iran. Under the declarations, the United States has agreed to take certain actions in connection with lawsuits regarding the Shah's wealth, but these are very carefully circumscribed. I don't think it's fully appreciated that the commitment to prohibit the transfer of the Shah-related property will arise only when Iran has filed a lawsuit against and served legal process on individuals who they claim are close relatives of the Shah, and only then will the property be temporarily frozen. Such a freeze order will remain in effect only until the litigation is determined. The likelihood is that even in the absence of a governmental freeze order, a court would have placed or would place approximately the same restrictions on the property in litigation by judicial order. Similarly, the requirement for the disclosure of information regarding the property of the former Shah or his family arises only upon the commencement of litigation and the proper service of defendants. Once a close relative of the Shah has been served in litigation, a person with information about property of his in the United States will be required to report it to the Treasury Department. But once again, I believe it's accurate to say that the information to be furnished to the Treasury is the same kind that would be available to a plaintiff under the normal civil discovery procedures in our federal courts. The other provisions of the declaration with respect to the Shah's property are in accord with existing U.S. law and protect the rights of the defendants in such litigation. Thus, I think, to sum up the matter, the United States refused to return the Shah to Iran prior to his death, and it has also steadfastly refused to confiscate or transfer his assets, insisting instead on the maintenance of the constitutional requirement of due process of law. Fifth, and the final point with respect to the agreement, I'd like to talk briefly about the claim settlement procedure. One of the most challenging issues throughout the negotiation was to provide a suitable method for United States nationals to pursue their commercial claims against Iran, while at the same time responding to Iran's demand for the return of its frozen assets and a nullification of claims encumbering those assets.